You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, queers, welcome to season 3, episode 9. We're talking shows today with me, Harrow, and Megan. Woo!
Thesis on Joan is a podcast dedicated to amplifying voices from the LGBTQ+ community in the New York performing arts scene and examining the industry from a queer perspective. Join us as we sit down with groundbreaking theater folks, both on stage and behind the curtain. For many queers, theater has been an escape, and this podcast looks to have open conversations on where we've come from and where we're headed as a community while queering the canon along the way.
Hey, Megan. We're here. It's just us today. Yay.
Just us. I feel like we've had such a fantastic run of amazing interviews. So, it's actually been a while since it's been just us recording.
Yeah, I like it. We get to check in more.
Yeah, exactly. How's it going?
It's good. I'm excited. We're into fall. I feel like I'm doing more things already because mm-hmm. the weather's so much nicer. I sat out in the park yesterday with my dog and ate and drank apple cider.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I'm like, this is the best. I love this. How about you?
Yeah, I agree. I feel like that temperature dropped last week and I'm like, now I'm my fully realized self again. I'm not saying I'm not still sweating through my clothes every time I go on the train and such, but, it's just a little more refreshing when you get off the train.
Yeah. So. I'm wearing layers now. It's great.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's my favorite fashion time of year.
Yes, so. Definitely.
That I used fashion in a strong way right there. I mean, I get to wear my flannels again and jeans.
So. More fashion. Yeah.
It works. Great.
I'm happy. Mm-hmm. I've been thinking a lot about transparency with my day job at work and how that applied to us. And I was just wondering if we could tell our listeners anything we want them to know about how this podcast, Thesis on Joan, is created. What would you want them to know?
That's a really good question. I would want them to know how much that we have taught ourselves how to do this. I feel like we came in with I was thinking this the other day when I was editing an episode. I'm like, two and a half years ago, I had no idea how to do this. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that's part of it is how much we just had this idea and we really wanted to make it a reality, so we just figured out the tools that we needed to do it and did it. Yeah. Not saying yay us, but saying it's easy for other people to do the same thing. It wasn't, the challenges for creating the podcast weren't as daunting as I thought they were before we got into it. Mm. I guess
I definitely agree, and I love the editing part now too.
It was probably what I was most scared for at the beginning. And then after the first year, I feel like it's, it's that math brain space. It's actually nice. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I think for me, it's when you first asked me to do the podcast, I had all this a rush of fear because I'm like, oh God, people will listen to what I think about things and judge me for it. And I've had to try and let that go and try and let my imposter syndrome go and talk to myself okay, we're just two queer people talking about our experiences with theater. We've both seen a lot of theater and we love theater, and
Yeah.
Hopefully people will find that interesting. And I don't have to be like the most educated person about it, or, you know, have the most brilliant take on something to be interesting. Yeah.
Even though you usually do. So
thank you. But it's nice to not have that pressure on myself, I would say.
Totally. And like, you know, we named our podcast Thesis, right?
Yeah.
So we're both like huge nerds. So I feel like doing homework, coming prepared to interviews, like we've creepily revealed to some of our interviewees, like how much we look into their lives. Like, yeah, I think we often try to do the most, but we don't necessarily have to your point. So.
And I appreciate our systems for how we like create the podcast. Like we kind of each take turns like producing an episode. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I think it's fun to do it that way, and it helps like space out the work evenly.
Yeah. And I have to say too, like I appreciate, you know, the grace that you grant me, and hopefully vice versa when we have something busy going on in our lives, you know. And I feel like that's something that is not present at most people's real jobs, you know, where you're like, oh, you have a big trip coming up, or you have this coming up. How can we make sure that this is actually going to work for you, so you're not just getting things dumped on you at a really busy time? So thank you for, I feel like you create that space at work for other people. So thanks for creating it at our podcast.
I hope so. And thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate our flexibility. And like, I think since we're friends too, that we understand that like we have other things in our lives that are very important to us. And we want to support each other being able to do those things too.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like do creative things with your friends, but also like, you know, have a good system in place so it continues to go well.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that too much, but I think it is hard to create things with your friends and remain friends. Yeah.
Yeah, creating things with friends, living with friends, like anytime you get into any type of long-term, you know, you're together in something, it has a potential to get tricky. So I feel like we're doing well.
Yeah.
So thank you.
I remember when we first met and talked about this, you said, like, I have a mission to be the best roommate ever or something like that. And I'm like, great, this is going to work so well.
Yeah. You can have good friends who are bad roommates.
Definitely. Right? Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks for checking in with me about that. We can jump into our show discussion, which is our main event today.
Yeah. And we actually have a lot to discuss, which is very exciting. I love the first one. I forgot we even went
until you
put it on there. The Taylor Mack songs from the Bark of Millions concert, which
back in
last week of June, right?
Yeah, it was for Pride.
It was like 5 days before I got COVID again.
Oh no!
But I'm glad we went. That was kind of like my Pride celebration. Oh. I didn't know that was going to be it.
Oh, right. I was so sad you couldn't come out for Pride.
It was, you know, it happens. It's fine. I got to keep everyone safe. But it was, wow, what a great experience that was, though. I wanted to go back and see, like, every night of shows.
What an incredible queer event. And I'm so glad it's just, like, in process and we haven't even seen, like, a full version yet.
Yeah. You know, it was like really fun because each song was about a different queer icon or person in history. And that week at school, I was doing like Pride lessons, and we had just done like a whole thing on Stormy DeLarvier, the bouncer who used to work at Cubbyhole and Stonewall, and this like butch icon. And one of the songs was like a lovely little like jazzy standard about Stormy, and I was just like crying. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like most people who even like have a tangential knowledge of like queer history don't know who this person is, and it's like a whole song about this person, and it just brought me so much joy.
Yeah, I felt like a bad queer because I'll admit that like a lot of the songs came and went, and there wasn't like a program or explanation of what the songs were called or who they were about, so you just had to like guess or not guess. And I probably didn't know who most of the songs were referring to, but I still had such an amazing time. And all the songs are incredible. They're so fun to listen to and beautiful.
So great.
And even if you don't know who they're about, it's just such a journey. And I think anything Taylor Mack does is wildly entertaining.
Totally. I think I only knew like three of the people the songs were about, but it didn't make it less entertaining. And like, I feel like I've seen Taylor Mac do this before, but this was the first time that Judy like really stepped back for a lot of it, which I loved too. And like had this wonderful queer cast. And like, do you remember that one part where Judy actually like went in the audience and watched part of the show?
Yeah. And then we got to watch Judy like climb back onto the stage in like giant heels and this like gigantic autumnal headdress. It was amazing. Oh,
it was so wonderful. Yeah, the costumes, even though it's in this tiny like Joe's Pub space, right? It was like, we're not going to tone down any costuming for that. It was.
And I bet the look every night was different too.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I cannot wait until I hope that it is staged in like the 24-hour concert format, because I'll do it. I love my sleep, but I will ruin it for that.
I'm still so sad I didn't get to go to that, but yeah, just I can't wait to see more of Taylor Mac's stuff. Like, it's always so incredible.
Yeah, I feel like I'm just on the couch sometimes on a weekend night, like watching TV, and I'm just like, what's Taylor Mac up to? Sadly, usually not a new show. So.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for Songs from Bark of Millions. Hopefully it will get, you know, a full production in the coming years and we can all go queer the fuck out at this production. It's going to be amazing. Something I saw over the summer, we're going back because I think I saw this
time travel
a couple of months ago, but I saw previous guest Nina Keys play Gamijo down at DR2. And I saw this a virtual reading of this like last year and was really moved by it. And it was so amazing to get to see it in person. It follows this, the story of a queer Korean adoptee who's like struggling with finding out that their birth mother doesn't want to meet them. And, they're in the LA scene and they're basically just like sleeping around with all the queer Asians of the LA scene. And
I love it.
Yeah. And I took a friend who felt like personally attacked by the show, but I think in a good way. but yeah, it was really incredible. Just like, I've never seen that kind of representation before of like parts of my identity and just like this kind of identity on stage. That was really amazing. And Nina Key is such a wonderful writer. I remember when I saw the virtual version, I gasped at many of the reveals and it still happened in person, even though I knew it was coming. It was great. So if you can check out another production of Nina Keys, I would highly recommend that.
And we have another show we're going to talk about similar to this, but having watched a digital version and then seeing it in person, were there things that were like extremely different than what you imagined they would be?
I think this happened also for the other show we're going to talk about, where this was kind of a highly dramatic show. And on Zoom, I think sometimes that can come across as like too melodramatic. And when you see it in person, it's like just right. It's like, yes, these are very high stake events. And like, these are the emotions someone would have in this event. And it doesn't feel like a lot. And I still really enjoyed the virtual version. But it's just so different seeing it on stage. Seeing the actors, it is like kind of double cast with similar actors and different characters, and just being able to see like costume changes and like physical body changes and the way they're playing the roles was really amazing too. So it was really great to see how each of them embodied the characters more. And it was a totally different cast too. So it was incredible to see just so many Asian people, and it looked like from reading the playbill or the program that they were all queer too. And just amazing. A cast full of queer Asians is a dream.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
fantastic.
Yeah.
And we love Nina. I'm so sad I missed that one. That's awesome.
Yeah. Hopefully there'll be more soon.
Yes. Fingers crossed.
Another show I got to see was The Nosebleed by Aya Ogawa, who was the writer, director, and a performer in the show. So...
Wow.
So talented. And then the rest of the ensemble cast kind of played versions of Aya that all represented kind of different identities of her, or different aspects of her identity. So like her queer self, herself as an Asian person. But yeah, they all played her in different scenes. And it was just a beautiful kind of like ritualistic meditation on relationships to fathers and how hers was not great. There was a lot of talking to the audience in interacting, we wrote down a list of questions we would like to ask our fathers, and then they collected them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was very intense.
That's heavy. Yeah.
And there was this whole ritual they did with the questions that was really beautiful. So there was like audience participation, but not in a terribly scary way. That felt, you felt really like honored to be a part of it, I think. Mm. Also, when Aya played her father, like all of a sudden their body just like transformed into like a 70-year-old man. It was incredible.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, it was such a fun show. There was a whole running joke about The Bachelor that was great. And it felt very queer and loving too. So I'm so glad I got to see that as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's great. What was the show that you had seen that they were in previously? Or
they directed Haruna Lee's Suicide Forest.
That's it.
That was one of the last shows I saw before everything shut down.
Yeah.
That was such a wacky, weird show.
Another one I'm sad I missed. I feel like I can never have a conversation about it, yeah. having not experienced it.
It's, yeah. It felt very, like, I think it was very based on, like, Buteux theater, and I don't know a lot about that, but it had, yeah, definitely had a lot of influence from that. Yeah, it was fun.
How cool to see all the different dimensions of her, like, artistry, though, with this show.
And it just felt very human and very vulnerable, like, revealing of where she was, and... Yeah, really appreciated it.
Nice. I didn't do a ton of theater going this summer because I was doing a lot of traveling, but I did want to shout out the Shakespeare in the Park production of As You Like It that was actually a revival or a restaging. I'm not really sure how they're phrasing it, of the 2017 version of it. Did you see the 2017 version?
No, I got rained out, I think, twice.
Oh, no. And that's why I brought it up, to make you feel bad.
I didn't even try this summer. I was like, it's just, I don't think it's meant to be.
Oh, man. Yeah, I played the lottery and that's how we ended up going. Mm-hmm. But it was just like so joyous and fun. And I did not realize that they had written in two queer like plots. Mm. So there's like, you know, Shakespeare comedy. It's three weddings at the end, and like the main one is still a straight presenting couple, but the other two were queer couples. And so it was just so fun to like have that be a surprise. You know, I'm just going because I'm like, oh, free Shakespeare in the Park. Great. And then it was like incredibly queer and very like emotionally manipulative, but in the way that you don't mind a Shakespeare in the Park show being. You're like, we're outside. It's beautiful. I'll cry at this intergenerational story, you know? But it was fun, and it was interesting to see another Shayna Taub joint, another Shayna Taub production after seeing Suffs. And this felt like very whimsical, you know, and very like, I don't know. I feel like Suffs was such a huge shift for her creative work. So I kind of enjoyed going back to the more fun whimsy of her songwriting. But yeah, it was great. Who knows? Maybe they'll bring it back. They've already done it twice.
Yeah, I think I was confused. I was like, I feel like this is the one I didn't get to see, but I almost saw. But I just know my luck with Shayna Taub and Shakespeare in the Park is not good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Well, the cast recording, I believe, from the 2017 version is available for streaming. So you can check out some of the queer love songs in there that are very fun.
Okay. So. Yeah, I haven't listened to it. I should. Yeah, I think I saw one song before it started pouring again. And they're like, no, I'm sorry.
So you even like got into the theater.
Both times I've been rained out, I've sat in the theater in the pouring rain for like 45 minutes before they finally were like, yeah, we're not going to go on.
Oh, I've been to Shakespeare in the Park twice in the rain, but only once it got called. And honestly, I was kind of glad it did. I was like, I'm kind of done with this King Lear. but once was during The Tempest, which was very fun actually, because it was like scenically appropriate, but, yeah, the risky run.
Yep. Yeah. I don't know. Give me air conditioning and indoors away from the bugs.
Yeah, this was like we got really lucky with lottery and weather. It was a once in a lifetime. It's never gonna happen again. So
Nice.
Might as well stop playing the lottery.
Yeah. And we both got to see Roger Q. Mason's Lavender Men,
mm-hmm.
a recording they streamed of the in-person production.
Yeah. It was so fun to see Roger's work. We had previously watched another play that Roger wrote.
The Duet. And this was so different.
Mm-hmm. It was incredibly different. And also I was thrilled. I knew Roger was in it from the marketing materials, but I was thrilled at like the full presence of Roger in it. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, I don't know. What were your first reactions to the show?
I was expecting something more like the Duet, I think, and mm-hmm. which is like a one-man show. It's very dark, very serious, beautiful. And this was very fun, kind of like a tongue-in-cheek comedy about Abraham Lincoln in mm-hmm. in a reality where he was queer and was in love with this other soldier that he worked with who was an attorney. And then Roger played like different characters, but mostly like Abraham Lincoln's like maid.
Also Mary Todd Lincoln for a bit. Yeah.
Right. Right before, this is before he was elected as president, and like the sacrifice that Abe had to give up this man that he loved to be president, basically. And I'm like, this is such a weird perspective for Roger to focus on.
Yeah.
But by the end, I think like it came full circle for me, where I'm like, oh, okay, they are like very empowered. They're telling this person, because they make a deal with the Abraham character at the beginning that it's like, if you tell the story, I will change the ending. Mm-hmm. And then when they get to the ending, the spoilers, they don't. They're like, no, sorry, this is my show.
Yeah.
And it's like commentary on how cis white gay men never want someone who looks like Roger, right? Who's black, who's fat, who's, you know, biracial. And how we look, I think, with more sympathy and empathy with love stories and characters like Abraham Lincoln and his lover, because there's just white gay men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like how, you know, we were watching it digitally, but I like how like complicit Roger makes the audience in it because of all the like fourth wall breaks, like, right? Like the audience is really brought into the story by the humor, and like, you know, the storytelling itself is very compelling, and then it kind of like throws it on its head, right? It's mm-hmm. like, well, y'all are cheering this on too. And to that point too, I just like the idea of, you know, so many people are doing revisionist histories for a variety of reasons, many reasons, like hateful, terrible ones, to write people out of revisionist history. And it's like, I love seeing revisionist history where, you know, queer folks, black folks, fat folks are put into the story. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it doesn't matter. I think Roger even says that, the character says that, like, this is a Fantasia. This is a story I'm telling. Like, you're asking, why am I doing this? How could I do this to your history? And the character's like, well, were you there? You don't know. You know? And I love that call out. And it's done a few times in the play to really remind the audience, like, stop being precious about this, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, definitely. There's a really beautiful, when the two men finally like hook up for the first time, mm-hmm. it turns into this like beautiful ballet. It was really awesome to watch it, but it was, yeah, then it gets broken of like, okay, but you would never want to see someone like me do that, right? You know? Mm. Yeah. And it was weird because I'm like, oh, you see Roger as like a very big presence who's very like confident in themselves, it seems. And like to see them in this character who's like very insecure and, you know, feeling unwanted. I'm glad that like by the end, we're like, okay, here you see Roger, like, or not Roger, I guess the character, and like mm-hmm. owning themselves.
Yeah. Stepping back into that power and like mm-hmm. taking it over.
Yeah.
I will continue to see everything that Roger Q. Mason writes or is in as long as I can. It's excited to check out their work at Breaking the Binary.
Yeah. And then I know there are two shows we want to talk about that we got to see in person together recently. The first is Once Upon a Korean Time
by Daniel K. Isaac, who we moved aside to take a picture of the poster. So Sorry, Daniel K. Isaac, if you're listening. We knew it was you. We just really wanted a picture of the poster together. So.
And we're too embarrassed and shy to say hi.
Would love to talk to Daniel K. Isaac, but very intimidated by the beauty of Daniel K. Isaac. So. Anyway, that's embarrassing. I've been just saying that on a podcast. But yes, this is, as mentioned earlier, this was the other show that we saw digitally. And now we finally got to see an in real life production of it.
Oh, and such a beautiful production. The projections were amazing. The set, the costume.
Puppetry.
Oh, the puppetry, right?
Yeah.
All those aspects were gorgeous.
It was one of those things where I felt like I really remembered what was going to be in the show. And even the things that were the same, I was like, totally, it was completely new with the staging of it. It was wonderful.
Absolutely. I think my favorite part of the virtual production was like the end scene where it's the queer Korean adoptee support group.
Right, which you forgot about somehow.
I forgot. Like, I knew that was my favorite part. And then when we got there to the in-person part and they got to that scene and they said that, I, like, gasped and clapped my hands.
Yep. I was like, oh, they're excited. Their favorite part's here. And then after the show, you're like, I forgot about that. I love it.
I remember mostly that I knew there was, like, the adoptee storyline. With the LA riots was the one I was remembering the most.
And the space was great. La Mama was a wonderful theater for that. Like, I just, it felt big in that space. Yeah. Like, it took up the whole space in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, and it's dealing with such huge themes of, like, war and depicting war and these, like, epic timelines that I think, yeah, it was a really great fit for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think seeing it on stage, because, I mean, I have to admit, I have a very bad memory. We were just talking about book club. Like, I can't read things too far in advance. So it was like watching it mostly for the first time for me. And I think this time through, like, the way the storyline weaved together was a lot easier for me to follow, seeing, like, the actual staging and interaction of the characters. Mm. Not that it was more difficult before, but this time it felt very... I don't know. It felt very cohesive in a really great way.
Yeah. I felt happy that I was starting to remember the folk stories because, you know, I didn't grow up knowing any Korean history or folk stories. And just hearing things, like, repeated helps me so much. Like, I'm not a big, you know, ironically, a big oral intaker of knowledge. I understand things much better by reading them. So just being able to, like, hear these stories told to me multiple times is really helpful for me to, like, ingrain them into my brain in a way that, like, the Little Red Riding Hood is, or, you know, any of the stories that are in Into the Woods, basically.
Yeah. You're like, if it's not in Into the Woods, I don't know it. The part that was, I mean, it's hard to pick up, like, this is my favorite part, but I think the part that was always the most effective for me both digitally and in person was the scene with the women who are essentially enslaved and are, you know, forced to I don't know what would be the best way to say this. They're basically raped by Japanese soldiers. That's what's happening to them. And as this, you know, horrific thing is happening, they're comforting each other through these folk tales, and it's just the juxtaposition, and you get so taken into the world of the folk tale, both through, like, their attachment to the story and the way that it's staged, so it actually separates you from, like, the horror for a while, and then it throws you back into it. It was just so effective and haunting, and I was really impressed with both the direction and the playwriting in that scene.
Yeah, such a heavy, difficult scene, and comfort women are a big part of Korean history. That, you know, they mentioned this in the show, that the Japanese denied that this happened. And it felt horrible to, like, know what was, you know, being portrayed off stage was happening at the same time you're listening to this story, but it did feel like this story is the lifeline to get you through the situation. Because you know, you have to get through and there's no other way really. But it's rough. It's really hard to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, you know, so jarring. Like, it's like, oh, now we're undersea with this like magical queer sea person and bubbles. And it's like, and now we're back and it's still horrible, you know? And it's, yeah, I'm not doing a good job explaining it, but it was really moving.
Mm-hmm. I love a good like connection of generations through, you know, following how people's children, you know, and the intergenerational trauma that happens, and also learning about the history of Korea and the Korean people, was really intricate and well woven together by Daniel, I thought, in a way that like probably a lot of people don't know about Korean history, and they learn from the show, which is amazing.
Yeah, I certainly did, and all of these folk tales were completely new to me, so it was, and I love the like self-awareness too sometimes, you know, it's like, well, this isn't, you know, with the adoptees at the end, they're like, well, this isn't like Western Cinderella, like listen how like fucked up this is, you know, like how different this version is. And I appreciated that a lot. I also appreciated, much like the next show we're going to talk about, I feel like we were in a very good audience with this in terms of reactions. Like, people were so like with it, gasping and like applauding, and it was, you know, just feeling that energy really helped make the experience too.
Yeah, I wanted to bring in an article that the New York Times put out recently about, it was called "Some Like It Not: Are Men in Dresses Still Funny?" And it's talking to all these folks about, you know, is the joke of a man in a dress still funny? Is it transphobic? Why are we still doing that? A lot of shows that we have seen together recently have featured like a drag moment, and it's all like femme drag.
It almost seems like you can't have a show today without it. Like, when I don't remember the last show I saw that didn't have a drag moment, which is very different than my earlier theater going experiences, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's, you know, Taylor Mack is always dressed.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a moment in Once Upon a Korean Time. There's a moment in the show we're going to talk about, American Televisions, Which Way to the Stage.
There was a moment in As You Like It that was like a drag moment.
Ah, Fat Ham.
Oh, yeah. Fat Ham.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's, you know, it's bad to say that, like, when it's not bad to say. An observation is, in Once Upon a Korean Time, when it happened, I was like, oh, yeah, it's the thing that happens, you know? like, it's no longer a huge surprise to me, I guess.
Yeah. I think when we were watching, we saw American Televisions yesterday, and when the drag moment is revealed, before it happened, I'm like, oh, it's going to be a drag moment. Like,
yeah. Yeah. You even like the lighting change. It's like, you know, almost bisexual lighting. It's like drag lighting. I don't know. You can tell it's coming, and there's usually some sort of curtainy thing that people have to go through.
Yeah.
and it's all used to very different effectiveness, right? Like, the Fat Ham one, which we haven't really talked about, Fat Ham, was like so incredible to me. Like, that one was earned. It was needed. It was like the relief that you had been traumatically working towards that whole play. And other times it feels a little arbitrary, and it's just to like, it feels like a cheap way to add some relief into a show. I'm not gonna really pinpoint anything specific right now, but I don't feel like it's always used in a mindful way. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. And I think, well, the article I feel like focused on the difference between like Mrs. Doubtfire and Tootsie versus like Strange Loop. And I didn't even think about Strange Loop as a drag moment, but I guess it is.
Yeah, I was like almost shocked that that got grouped in with it, because it is, but I don't think of that. And it's also the way that that actor is performing the mother. It's not, it's more an exaggeration of being that type of mother than it is an exaggeration of being like a feminine presenting person. I don't know.
And there's cis men portraying women, you know, through the whole show too. So I'm not sure why like that moment Is the actor in a dress at that point? I think he is. And then it mentions in the article that he off on Playwrights Horizons wore a wig, and I do distinctly remember that. And then the moment when he takes it off. That. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not in a wig for the Broadway production. But yeah, that feels very different to me than like these like production number moments in some of these other shows.
Yeah.
It's just like an actor portraying, it feels like an actor portraying a character. And then I feel like Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire are in like a whole separate other league.
And it's like the intention behind it, right? And to me, it's always who's creating the thing, mm-hmm. right? And we know that Michael R. Jackson is creating this, and it's being created for, you know, mostly Black queers. It is created for Black queers, and like Tootsie is not.
Yeah. You know?
So there was like a line in that article, Charles Bush was saying like, you know, people used to, it was like gay panic horror, right? And he literally says audiences are beyond that now. And I strongly disagree.
Yeah.
And then even like Taylor Mack came in and said like, well, it's like interesting when it's men performing women as men, but I think Taylor Mack's giving the audience too much credit. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that most folks are going to be able to make that distinction. And I think most people are going to see, I don't know. I see what they're trying to say as artists, but I don't think that the audience is actually reading it the way that they hope they are.
Yeah. And I really appreciated what Elle Morgan's contributions in the article and, you know, her saying, you know, it can be really harmful and dangerous because if people, you know, see a man in a dress as a joke, if, you know, they find a trans woman, it can lead to violence against them because they think it's a joke. And that's really dangerous. And she's like, you know, my show has that moment in it and my show doesn't get a pass either.
Yeah, that was super interesting. I'm glad she called that out. Mm-hmm. And just like saying like, why do we even need to be doing this? Right. Yeah. Like, that's the question. And no one seems to have a good answer for it or even a good reason to include it.
It's interesting. The playwright of Which Way to the Stage talks about how, oh, it's always femme drag. We never see like women in masculine drag. And I'm like, that's so funny because that's what Megan and I were saying about her show. We would have loved to see. that character in mask drag.
We're like, listen up.
Yeah.
That would have, and that's the problem, right? Is that everyone has like this fixed, and that when you go to a show, if there's a drag moment, you could pretty much say exactly what that moment's going to look like. I think that's why Strange Loop feels so different, because the actor is not putting on these like over the top outfits, like the actor's just putting on like a skirt and coming out and singing a song. it doesn't feel like it's not meeting the audience expectations.
And I think there's such a huge difference between shows like Tootsie and Mrs. Doubtfire, where it's like the joke is a man in a dress, versus like we are commenting on gender and having a fabulous moment. Mm-hmm. And celebrating drag.
Right.
Versus like,
which is like fat ham.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Versus like, isn't it ridiculous that a man could ever pass as a woman in a dress?
Right.
Which is what the other two shows are, I think.
I'm like, sorry, if you're making commercial theater for a mass audience, that's probably the joke you're doing, even if you're not trying to.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably how it's being read, even if there's no intention of that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And I have not seen either of those shows either. So, you know.
Well, for very good reason.
Yeah.
I did see Tootsie. I got a free ticket and it was, you know, exactly what we all feared. So it was like Elle Morgan said, like, this is irresponsible. Mm-hmm. You know, why is this even happening? We've moved beyond it. We're better than this as a theater community.
And if we keep producing shows like that and perpetuating this idea, like that danger, that harm is still just going to keep being out there.
Mm-hmm. And it cheapens like those really well deserved wonderful moments like in Fat Ham. Mm-hmm. You know, because then it's like if you see drag in every show, then it's the effectiveness of it when it's actually used in a way that serves the story is going to go away.
Yeah,
that article needed to come out like 5 years ago.
It did. And I don't know why. I guess there's a lot. There's a drag or a lot of drag in Some Like It Hot, and I have not seen that yet.
Either. Which I had no idea. I don't know anything about that show.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't know from the advertising that there's drag in it.
Yeah.
So, who knows?
Back to Once Upon a Korean Time.
Yeah, sorry.
But it is really interesting that the article came out, and I was, and now as we've been seeing more shows, I'm like, God, this is in every single show we've seen lately. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. And it's all femme drag, yeah.
Drag in the multiverse.
Oh, except Suffs. Suffs had mask drag.
Oh, it did. Yeah. But you know what? Mask drag, there's so, it's so few and far between that it's, I feel like it's never used in a way that's like a throwaway because it's so uncommon.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it is. I just haven't seen it.
And that was like one of my favorite parts of the show. So
it was my favorite part. Yeah.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So very fresh. Our last episode was with the playwright Victor Icazares, who was the writer of American Televisions, Televisions, parentheses. But this is super fresh. We just saw the show yesterday. They saw the matinee. And yeah, so we can check in on what we were thinking, but I hadn't been to the workshop since way before the pandemic. I know you've seen a couple of shows there since, but it was just so great to be back in that space. And I feel like anytime I walk into a show there, I'm always like, whoa, what's going to be different? And this did not disappoint. It looked completely different the minute we walked into the room.
Yeah, it looked huge, right?
Mm-hmm.
The way, like, the whole design and tech aspect of the show was mind-blowing. So impressive. But there were so many, it's huge on multimedia. There's screens, like the whole set are different screens. There's different projections everywhere. There's so many amazing surprises in the set, like the reveals of what there are these big metal box crates on stage. Mm-hmm. And you get to see inside all of them. This is going to be a very spoiler filled discussion.
Yes.
And I felt, yeah, each reveal I thought was so fun.
Yeah, I know. As soon as I couldn't tell, you know, like those big boxes, I thought, oh, maybe they're just like a surface area for projection. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as the first one opened, I'm like, oh, yes, this is going to be. It's so funny. Like the show has so many elements of like childlike whimsy, whether it's with actual toys or with video games, and then the set itself almost has like a Polly Pocket vibe of like how a little kid would like structure their world if they were telling a story about their life. It's like, over here's the Barbie aisle and over here is our living room, you know. Mm-hmm. So I thought like thematically the set worked really well too.
Yeah, it was so great. The cast was incredible, every single one of them so strong.
Yeah, the cast was amazing. And it was, besides Ryan, I hadn't seen any of these performers before. And the way that they jump between like the different timelines and the different roles, it's like acting masterclass up there. And many of them, the performer who plays the lead, well, I guess I don't even know if you can say it's a lead, but the character who's on stage the most, I was like, you're on stage this entire 100-minute show.
Yeah.
This is incredible.
And then they start doing like backflips and one-handed cartwheels and
it was so cool.
I have seen Raul Castillo, who plays the father in Looking.
Oh, okay. I'm like, how do I know this person?
Yeah.
That's it. Okay.
So that was fun to see. And he's in Vita.
He's very hot.
Yeah, he's great.
Into that.
And he plays this really kind of abusive father figure, but you also feel for him so much. Yeah. Like, what a complicated person. I think that's a feat to really, like, give humanity to someone who's abusive like that. Yeah.
It reminds me of some of our conversations around How I Learned to Drive. I'm like, why do I feel anything for this character? Mm. And I think it's because you live in their, like, sadness so long before the, like, their abusive nature comes out. But yeah, maybe it's also because I recognize him from Vita, so I just felt bad for him. Unclear.
Yeah, there were some amazing costume moments as well. Victor had mentioned that you brought this up because I had forgotten the Project Runway designer did two of the special costumes, I think. What they call it, and they are incredible.
That last, I mean, they were both great, but that last one is like a whole performance art piece on its own.
Yeah.
It's very incredible.
The show focuses on an illegal Mexican family in the neighborhood where the very first Walmart was built. And there's a whole like running theme of like a old Nintendo game, like kind of Mario Brothers-esque game, and in the end they get to like the final boss fight, and it's the mother character in this full Walmart receipt gown. That's
Walmartina.
Yes, Walmartina. Yes. Covered in like barcodes and prices. It's so good though.
Yeah. And we were saying as we were leaving the theater and talking with the folks that we went with, how like we fell right in the age gap for the show. Yeah. With some of the references between like the video games and the just like Walmart visuals and pricing. Mm. But Harold, you were saying you're a recent video game person.
Yeah. Right? I did have a Nintendo, like the one they had in the show when I was younger, but the only games I really played was Tetris, and I had Mario, but I was not good at it at all. So I hadn't really played video games like my whole adult life. And then when the pandemic hit, I got a Switch, and now I play it every day, I think. So I'm like, oh, now I like recognize video game like mechanics that are in a lot of different games, and just appreciating the like the secret code thing of trying to beat like hard fights, and you press the keys in a certain order to, you know, unlock special abilities. That was all great.
It was so good. Yeah, when Ryan just yells up, up, down, B. What a great line. Yeah, I loved how much of it, because I had like the Game Boy when I was a kid, and I was so much of the Legend of Zelda iconography was used in the show, which brought me so much joy. And, you know, it makes you, the way that the story is nonlinear, but also like non-reality focused a lot of the time. So like if you were a little kid and all of this stuff was going on around you, you would kind of put it in terms you could understand, like maybe this is just a quest I have to defeat, and I can gather these items, and there's always a solution, right? You can always win the game. And I thought that was really interesting how Victor was able to like make it make sense in the mind of a, I'm assuming that character was like somewhere between like 10 and 15.
I re-listened to our episode with Victor this morning, and them just saying you are what you watch, I think still just hits me in such a weird way. And it's interesting to think about like video games, and is that what it is, watching, but it's also participating in a way that is kind of like life, where you're making choices and making moves, but in this very controlled environment. And yeah, I think you're exactly right. Like the main character, Erica, is trying to do that with all this like trauma she's experiencing, but it can end as like cleanly as she wants it to.
And I mean, I just have to talk about Ryan a little bit more as well, because this is my first time seeing Ryan like perform live, just having seen digital shows. But like, wow, just so wonderful. I feel like this role too is so fun because it is like the comic relief like character role, which this show like desperately needs.
Definitely.
But yeah, it was I just felt like he was very much in his element and the audience was like losing it for
him. Oh yeah. He was so wonderful and had some great moments of like gravitas and dramatic moments too, I thought.
Yeah. The detectives part was my favorite.
Yeah. And they had such a great friendship. The two, the younger people had such a great friendship. It's interesting because Victor was saying how, you know, they wrote this show a long time ago. I think it was like early 2013 or something.
I think they said they've been working on it for at least 15 years now. So even earlier than that. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were like, you know, Walmart was a huge thing back then. And we thought it was going to be like, you know, the biggest boss of capitalism. And, you know, I feel like, yeah, we aren't talking about Walmart as much these days, but like it was so easily like supplant that with like Amazon or whatever, you know, and it totally felt completely relevant.
Oh yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Probably even more relevant now than it was then. Mm-hmm. I would say.
And even I feel like in areas outside of New York, I would say places like Walmart still have like such a huge hold on economies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like we were saying when we were leaving the theater, we're like, our dads love Walmart.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of other stores in town, but the way it's positioned, it is the cheapest, easiest, most efficient place for my family to get a lot of their stuff.
Yeah.
So you see how it easily takes over a community.
Definitely. And to think about like the very first Walmart and just, you know, the dawning of this new time.
Wild.
Yeah. And the fact that like there's this all this about how the night that never ended, or I forget the exact phrase, but like basically the lights from the Walmart, I guess, parking lot were so bright that like it just made it feel like day all the time. And it like disrupted this family's sleep. And they had weird work. They had like really atrocious work schedules anyway, where they're like working in the night shift and sleeping in the day. So yeah, just the tiny like local impacts of a Walmart on this family too was really poignant.
Yeah, and had huge consequences for their lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was way more gay than we thought it was going to be. Not that we didn't think it was going to be gay, but it was very queer.
Yes, definitely. With themselves. What do you think was the thought behind like having the same actor play like these two young guys who were in love with each other?
Yeah, I don't know, honestly. Yeah. I was trying to think about that this morning too, and I don't know if it's a comment on like people see like young people who are not identifying the way they want them to as like interchangeable or not like as a whole person, or maybe it was there was a line saying that they were like they were each other, like towards the end was saying like, well, I am him and he is me and like he's still here. So maybe it was that. But yeah, that was not easy to untangle. What do you think?
Well, part of me was like, is this just like a producing choice because it was less expensive to have one actor?
Especially one that's not on stage for most of the show.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. And it was interesting to me because it was so race specific too. And the family is Mexican, and then it was the actor who played Jesse and Alejandro, I think they said was Vietnamese. So I wondered like why that choice was made too.
Yeah, I don't know about the acting choice, but I feel like the story choice was really interesting when they get to the end and they're like, don't tell dad that you're a legal immigrant. So that was like, I feel like the reason that that character, I don't know. It was a huge surprise for some people in the audience who did not realize they were the same person.
Yeah.
Not calling anyone out. It was just like interesting.
Well, it's because Alejandro, you know, you never see like his full, he's only appears for most of the show on screen in like a video. And most of it, he's like pixelated or like distorted in some way. So you don't get like a super clear image of his face. So, you know, maybe there's confusion about that.
That's giving them a lot of benefit of the doubt there. Yeah, it did like, it took me a minute though, when the actor came back out to be like, are you Alejandro now?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was a little confused on that. Yeah, I will say that even though we talked to Victor and they had warned us about this and told us, like, you know, don't fall into the trap of linear storytelling. As I was watching it, I was still actively doing that and having a hard time probably the first, like, little less than first half of the show, like, trying to make it fit into something that, like, my linear focused mind is used to.
Yes.
Eventually, when I gave up on that, I feel like I was able to, like, experience the show in a much fuller way. But the beginning, I was like, why am I doing this? I know I'm not supposed to be doing this. And I'm still trying to make it make sense, you know?
Yeah. I think I was still, like, the moment I was confused about, I was like, oh, wait, is the mom actually, and the dad, I felt clear that the dad wasn't dead at the end, right? And then the mom, I wasn't sure, because I'm like, wait, did she really run away with Stanley? Or was that just, like, something Erica made up in her mind?
I don't know. Because it could be real in, like, one reality and not real in another. And maybe it's real in Erica's video game. Yeah, it's really hard to understand.
But, you know, I'm fine not knowing either way. I think
there
were so many lines where I was like, oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, I know. I would love to read the script of it for sure. And I'm not going to say, like, good on them because they should be doing this anyway, but, like, I'm glad that this show exists at this scale at New York Theater Workshop. So it should be what they're always putting their money towards. But it was, because I can imagine Victor's frustration, which they shared with us, of, like, you know, getting this on its feet and, like, how do you do this at Music Stands and understand what it is?
Yeah.
You know, you need the full effects of the production.
And they were pretty seamless. Like, I was so impressed how epic it was in the tech and just how smooth everything went.
Yeah. Yeah. Release the tapes of the stage manager. We want to hear them call the show.
It was great.
Yeah. Sadly, it will be over by the time this episode comes out, but hopefully folks listen to our Victor interview and are going to see it. Also playing on Broadway this fall is 1776, the musical, a production that I've never seen, Harold's never seen. it's at the American Airlines Theater. It's a roundabout production. It is a all non-cis male cast. I'm not sure exactly how they're phrasing it. And it is led, interestingly, by two directors, one of them being Diane Paulus. So I'm very intrigued to see what this is. And I love that I'm probably going to go in having never seen anything about this show before and just experience this version only of 1776.
It's not a show I've ever been excited to see, but now I'm intrigued. I want to see it.
Yeah. I think this is the only way I would ever go. And it's playing through January 8th. Another show coming to Broadway this fall, previews begin October 28th, is Anne Juliet. It's not the word and, it's the ampersand, Anne Juliet, the new musical. So I'm curious about this because, like you said, Harrow, I also have heard this is queer, but I don't know how or why or what. I will say I got the mailer for this recently and this is clearly not a unbiased presentation of these shows. I got the mailer of this and was, like, confused to see that it's mostly pop songs in the style of Moulin Rouge. So curious to see. I wasn't a huge fan of how that worked in Moulin Rouge, but Moulin Rouge was not really that gay. So if this can be, if this can be gay and also hit me with, some Britney Spears, I might be more into it.
I'm excited for Betsy Wolf. I love some Betsy Wolf.
Oh, I didn't know. Okay. Wait, that ups my excitement a lot. Like, I really like Betsy Wolf. Yeah.
She's great. Some off-Broadway shows that we're going to try and check out. There's a show called I Wanna Fuck Like Romeo and Juliet. I don't know if that's how they're pronouncing it. There's an asterisk in the U of the F word.
A lot of choices this fall with the titles.
This is, I'm going to read the blurb. Snow in July, comets falling from the sky. The world is thrown into chaos as Cupid rips off her wings and gives up on love. But her old flame, Saint Valentine, has a plan to bring her spirit back up. And it involves reigniting the flame between two humans, another Alejandro, and Benny. Moving from The Heavens to Hackensack, I Want to Fuck Like Romeo and Juliet is a love story of epic proportions that investigates gods and mortals, realism and fantasy, and the shame and joy within queer love of color. This is presented as part of the New Light Theater Project's 2022 New Light, New Voices Fall Festival, and begins previews October 20th and runs through November 5th at 59E 59 Theaters.
Ooh.
So another show that is coming from Parody Productions is Turning Krishnishi. This is the story of Hannah Krishnishi, a high school senior in a small conservative Kentucky town who transitions to become a Bernicia, a gender in his ancestral homeland of Albania. There are several problems with this, of course. Hannah has never been to Albania. Almost no one has transitioned to become a Bernicia in decades, leaving only a fairly antiquated ritual that requires taking an oath in front of 12 village elders as guidance. Hannah has no elders, but he's determined not to let that stop him. Can Hannah get the support he needs in order to overcome his transphobic principle and transition according to the ancient rules of the Bernicia transition? And that is playing November 3rd through 6th at AMT Theater.
Another show that I'm excited about is called The Patient Gloria, and this is going to be at St. Anne's Warehouse. I'm a fan of most things that happen in St. Anne's Warehouse. I feel like I've never had a bad artistic experience there. But it's written by the playwright Gina Moxley, an Irish playwright. And this is the blurb: a gloriously ballsy meditation on therapy, misogyny, and female desire based on the 1965 films Three Approaches to Psychotherapy or the Gloria films. It's a punky mashup of reenactment, actual footage, and lived experience. So the playwright is also playing the therapist, which, unsure, have not been able to confirm, I believe, is like playing it in male drag. So that is interesting to me. Well, the playwright is also a director and directed a show I saw a few years ago at Irish Arts Center called How to Keep an Alien, that was about this Irish lesbian woman trying to figure out how to get citizenship for her partner at the time, who was an alien. And was also, this partner was also the stage manager of the show. So it worked out. They were together. They had a great queer romance. But just based on that directing style, I feel like I'm going to enjoy this piece by Gina Moxley.
Amazing.
So going to check it out. $49 tickets.
There's a bunch of shows y'all can see, and please tell us what we've missed. We want to shout it out on social media if we can. So jumping over to our action of the ep, we want to shout out for folks to support the Fair Chance for Housing campaign. And this is a coalition of advocates, legal services, human service providers, and people who have experienced housing discrimination. So these folks believe that housing is a human right, and allowing justice-involved people equal access to safe and stable housing strengthens our communities and makes us all safer.
Their goal is to pass the Fair Chance for Housing Act in New York City Council to protect people with conviction records from housing discrimination. Conviction has an end date, shouldn't the punishment? Our mass policing, arrests, and incarceration policies have disproportionately targeted communities of color. These structural inequalities have disproportionate effects on Black communities. As a result, 80% of New York City residents with a conviction are Black or Latinx. Criminal background checks have been used far too long to perpetuate racial bias and exclude people from housing. Their site says we cannot end racial discrimination in housing if we don't end conviction record discrimination.
So you can visit their website. They have a Take Action page, and from there you can sign up for updates from their campaign. They also have a super easy way for you to email your city council members and Mayor Eric Adams. You can also use their forms to tweet your city council member to support this legislation.
So we had a busy summer of TV watching. Oh, I finally watched Vita.
Yay!
But not the most recent season because I can't find out how to find it. But we both started watching and finished watching A League of Their Own.
Yes, and some of us have watched it twice already.
Amazing. I know. I got to circle back and do a rewatch. Like, I let it simmer for a few weeks. I'm ready.
Yeah. I think the first time it was just me losing my mind a lot. So I needed to go back and like take in some more subtle moments I might have missed the first time.
Yeah. Well, it was like shockingly queer, right? Yes. Like, I expected it to be queer because I was like, okay, Abby Jacobson, it's also now 2022. Mm-hmm. Great. But like, I had no idea the extent of queerness that show was going to be. Were you surprised?
Oh, I was shocked. And I had even heard that it's super queer. And I'm just like, oh, everyone. Oh, the main thing is queer. Ah! Both of the main things are queer. Ah!
It's so wild. I know. I was like, we couldn't possibly have both, could we? Yes. Yeah. Everything is queer.
Yes.
Did I tell you what my dad said? My mom and dad watched it over the course of like 3 days. And like the last episode, my dad looked at my mom and he was like, that was kind of more about being gay than baseball, huh? It's like, this is so good. But he still loved it. His favorite character is, I don't remember the character's name, but it's kind of the other like hard tomboy type that's from Canada. Oh, his Jess? Favorite character. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jess
yeah,
is my
yeah.
dad's favorite.
Amazing. So many good queer moments. I think my favorite. Okay, spoilers for A League of Their Own, but my favorite moment is when they finally go to the gay bar together.
So great.
And Jess and Roberta's character are just mm-hmm. like, yeah, we're gay. Yeah, we sleep with a bunch of women.
Obviously. It was so great because it was like, you know, I feel like it almost played on like the emotions of queer viewers never getting the payout they want, yeah. right? Because I'm watching it, I'm like, God, those two have to be gay. Like, there's no way those characters aren't gay. And then you get to that scene, and they're like, obviously. And I'm like, oh, okay, good.
So satisfying.
Yeah, yes. It was. That episode was so emotional, and it's just like beautiful too. That mm-hmm. show.
I cried several times through the series.
Oh, yeah, same. Yeah. Do you have a favorite character?
Well, okay, I didn't know that I would be so into Janet from The Good Place, but dear Lord, it's a problem. Yeah.
It's a problem. I don't think it's a problem.
Well, the problem, she's not queer. She's not out as queer. I don't know.
It's shocking that she's not, but... Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, me and every queer that has seen the series now, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But our original Joan also, you know, she's great. Roberta Calandra's always.
I mean, don't talk to me about Roberta. Like, wonderful. Exactly. Well, we were saying too, like, it's kind of fun to see Roberta be like a different character than just like the heartthrobby type. Yeah. You know, it's like kind of a more complex, almost like antagonistic role for a little bit, which mm-hmm. is fun. And I'm like obsessed with Uncle Birdie. Uncle Birdie is my favorite. That was when the show really broke me. I'm like, you're gonna give us like a trans like male elder too? Like, yeah. How is this happening?
Oh, that was beautiful.
So wonderful.
And he makes the suit. Ugh.
Yeah. All the feelings.
Yeah.
It's also just like nice, again, like knowing the manipulation queer audiences have been through, to have so many like happy things handed to you. Mm-hmm. You know, like there are some, it's the times, like of course things are going to have to not all work out for these characters in the world that they're in. Mm-hmm. But there's so many wins and so many great like love, romantic moments, and it's friendships and
yeah
it's nice to have some joy. This is the queer joy we always ask for.
Yeah. Well, if you can't tell, we highly recommend this series.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll bring it up like way more.
It's on Amazon Prime. Go enjoy it.
You probably already have.
Yeah. Preaching to the choir, but I'm glad we got to talk about it more on the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on this adventure through the past shows of the last 6 months, I think.
Yes. And all of the things we're excited about for the fall season. We're excited to hear what you're looking forward to as well.
Thanks for listening. If you like, please follow, rate, and review us, and share us with your friends.
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at @ThesisOnJoan.
We love to hear your queer culture recs and ideas for queering the canon. Send us an email at thesisonjoan@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 845-445-9251.
Come back for more interviews, fun queer content, recommendations, and discussions on current theater.
Until next time, keep it queer.
Not that it'd be that hard for y'all to do. I think my sister listens to this occasionally and she would agree with this statement. But I remember one time, like it was my second year of college and I was getting a new roommate. It was like a situation I was worried about. And I was talking to my mom and I was like, I just feel like I've always had good roommate situations, but like Kate has had such terrible roommate situations and I'm just worried I'm going to be a bad roommate. And she's like, who was your roommate for 18 years? I was like, Kate. She's like, that, there it is. Aww. She's like, you've had to be a good roommate. Like, she's like, cause she's a bad roommate, but we cut that out. Cut that out.
That's our blooper.
Yeah. But yeah, Kate was a bad roommate.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.